From Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology News, this is the GenCast Network. Bringing you compelling and in-depth interviews with the biotech industry's leading researchers, newsmakers, and thought leaders. This week on the GenCast Network. Dr. Steve Goldman from the University of Rochester Medical Center is interviewed by Gen's editor-in-chief John Sterling about using human stem cells to improve the condition of neurologically impaired mice.
Dr. Steve Goldman is professor of neurology and chief of the Division of Cell and Gene Therapy at the University of Rochester Medical Center. In the June issue of the journal Cell Stem Cell, he and colleagues from Cornell, UCLA, and Baylor reported what might be the first documented rescue of a congenital brain disorder by transplantation of human neural stem cells. Dr. Goldman, you and a team of collaborators recently published details on the transplantation of human glial stem cells into neonatal shiverer mice. What was the purpose of your experiment, and what were the results?
This was an experiment done to assess the competence of glial progenitor cells. These are cells that are capable of giving rise both to oligodendrocytes, the myelinating cell type of the brain, and astrocytes. Their competence in treating animal models of leukodystrophy, of congenital absence of myelin. The idea was to use these cells to infiltrate the brains of young animals who suffered from genetic disorders that prevented them from producing myelin, and to see whether by infiltrating the brains of these animals at very early stages in their development with these cells, whether we would be able to rescue the phenotype. In other words, whether we'd be able to myelinate these brains and spinal cords that would otherwise not be myelinated. In the normal course of affairs, these animals, and we used one specific model in this experiment called the shiver mouse, die typically at about 20 weeks of age. And what we were hoping was that we would achieve sufficient myelination of the nervous system of these animals to at least delay the onset of disease symptoms. Typically, shiverer mice become quite impaired as they get older, as they progress through the first few months postnatally. They're called shivers because they're frequently shaking as they try to ambulate forward. They have this very coarse shaking motion, but it's also very rapid, and so to some eyes it appears as though they're shivering, hence the name. Also, they seize a lot. They develop epileptic seizures, which become quite severe. And so with that constellation of relatively dramatic phenotypes, both appearing to shiver and shake and seize, the name, of course, is very appropriate then. So the shiver mouse typically, again, dies at about 20 weeks. Nothing that had ever been done before had ever given it an extra day of life. And we really didn't expect that what we were doing would necessarily do so either, but we did want to see whether we had a cell population that was competent to myelinate significant proportions of brain volume, and if so, whether we would see any change in the phenotype of these animals. And what we found was that indeed the animals exhibited a significant change as a group in their phenotype. As they became older, they, like the untreated animals, suffered a really significant neurologic deterioration. So that both the treated and the untreated animals, when they're 8 to 10 weeks of age, by that point they're really clearly very impaired. Ambulation becomes difficult. Walking forward, they begin to walk backwards more and more. They have extraordinary shaking on forward ambulation, develop seizures. So all of this was no different between the treated and untreated animals until about 18 weeks or so. And at that point, the animals started to die, control animals and treated both, but most of the treated animals seemed to be living longer. And so that although some treated animals died at the same time as the controls, most of them lived for at least several weeks longer. So whereas all the control animals were dead by 21 weeks, the control animals, the treated animals rather, would go to 22, 23, 24 weeks. And slowly but surely, those that survived longer seemed to be exhibiting a diminution in their neurologic abnormalities. So that by the time we got to about 160, 170 days, it was clear that there was a fraction of animals that were not only still alive, but were improving neurologically. So we followed those animals, and again, this is a minority of the whole. It was less than a third of the total, but about a quarter of the animals actually survived for much longer periods of time. And as they did so, their neurologic conditions steadily improved so that they began ambulating more functionally, exploring their environments more, and most specifically, the incidence and durations, both of their epileptic seizures, fell. They started to seize less, started to seize for much shorter periods, and the incidence of status epilepticus, in other words, prolonged seizure events that typically are the cause of death of these animals, that essentially stopped. So that by the time the animals were 9 months of age, and of course by that point they're almost twice the normal lifespan of a shiver mouse, they had largely ceased epileptic activity and were well on their way to significant recovery neurologically. By the time we were out at 14 months, actually 13 to 14 months of age, over a year, we decided that those animals that still survived, at that point we empirically decided they were rescued because they appeared neurologically virtually normal. They had no seizure activity whatsoever by that point. The epileptic events had long since ceased. They had absolutely normal exploration of their environment and ambulation, and really just a mild truncal tremor on forward ambulation was the only residual of their prior neurologic abnormality. So at that point, we stopped the experiment and killed the remaining animals to look at their patterns of myelination, at the extent to which these cells had successfully myelinated the nervous systems of these animals. So normally, shiver mice make no myelin. That's because they have a mutation in the myelin basic protein gene, so they never make this protein, myelin basic protein, which is a really critical component of myelin. And so when we look for myelin basic protein at the protein level by immunocytochemistry in the normal shiver mouse, there is none. There's no immunodetectable myelin basic protein. When we looked in the treated animals, we saw a really extraordinary myelination, an absolutely normal pattern of myelin basic protein expression throughout not just the brain, but the entire nervous systems of these animals, at least the entire central nervous systems, so that the brainstem, cerebellum, spinal cord, spinal roots, the cranial roots, were all fully myelinated.
And what conclusion did you draw from this?
There are a number of conclusions, but the first and most important was that the glial progenitor cells that we were deriving from fetal tissues were competent to myelinate with very high efficiency after transplantation to this congenitally hypomyelinated model. And so that was the first and foremost conclusion, that the cells that we were isolating through very specific methods for identifying and then purifying glial progenitor cells from human tissues, that those cells were fully competent to disperse throughout a recipient nervous system, to ensheath the resident axons, and in this case, these are xenografts, and so these are mouse axons that these cells are ensheathing, and they're fully competent to do so, and to generate absolutely normal myelin, normal ultrastructurally, normal in terms of the electrophysiologic competence of the axons that are then myelinated, the conduction velocities of those axons once they're myelinated by the donor cells return to normal, the architecture of the nodes of Ranvier, the conduction units along an axon, that was absolutely normal in these. And so that told us that these cells were good from the standpoint of being appropriate donor vectors for achieving myelination in a either hypomyelinated or demyelinated host. And so that was first and foremost. Besides that biologic point, we were really astounded to realize that we could not only treat but cure a hereditary disease of myelin. This was previously considered uniformly a necessarily fatal disorder of, in this case, these mice. And we had no a priori expectation that the cellular treatment we used would actually cure the animals, but it appeared to do so. And so that told us that the potential is there for actually treating this entire spectrum of disorders, the pediatric leukodystrophies, with curative intent. And I think that's potentially a new concept, at least in a realistic sense. Most neurologists, myself included, look at neurologic disease as most chronic medical disease from the standpoint of treating for improvement, treating for increasing levels of function, treating for increasing life expectancy. But treating for cure is not something that we often have the opportunity to do. But here with a category of hereditary disease that we had never really previously thought in curative terms, and now we're faced with the situation that we can start to conceive of at least some of these diseases as potentially being curable through cell-based strategies.
I want to pick up on that point here. You discussed this a little bit, but could you once again provide some examples, because I'm going to lead into another question here, some examples of disorders of congenital and perinatal hypomyelination in animals and humans, if there are any.
Well, there are a number of animal models of human diseases, and so perhaps the best frame of reference would be human disease. So there's a category of disorders of myelination that we call the pediatric leukodystrophies that break down into a great number of distinct disorders of both hypomyelination, meaning myelin doesn't form in the first place, or dysmyelination, meaning that abnormal myelin forms, or myelin forms and then degrades, or demyelination, meaning myelin forms and it's normal myelin but then is lost by virtue of a disease process. Hypomyelinating syndromes in many ways are the simplest pathologically, and the shiver mouse is indeed a hypomyelinating mouse model. Now, it's a mouse model that doesn't genetically replicate any specific human disease except for very, very rare myelin basic protein genetic abnormalities in humans, literally only a few families reported. But there is a larger category of disease. Syndrome called Pilzaeus-Merzbacher disease that represents actually several different genotypes that all share abnormalities in expression of a protein called proteolipid protein. And the in some cases it's a reduplication of the gene, and others mutations within the gene. But the bottom line is that when proteolipid protein is not produced appropriately, and this is a protein that's very key in myelin synthesis and maintenance, then infants, children, don't develop normal myelin. And Pilzaeus-Merzbacher is represented by a couple of genetic models, the Gympie mouse, the Rumpshaker mouse, that have pathologic similarity to shiver. And these children in many ways are like shiver mice in that they simply never develop functional myelin. And in some cases, they develop enough quasi-functional myelin to at least have some degree of survival as children. In the worst cases, what's called conatal Pilzaeus-Merzbacher disease, not even that much myelin is generated. They make none whatsoever and die typically as infants. But these are terrible diseases. Whether the disorder is one of an absence of POP or an overexpression of POP or a mutation in it with aberrant function. Again, Pilzaeus-Merzbacher includes all those categories. Across the board, the bottom line is that the infants and children afflicted with the disorder don't develop normally, generally die young, and even in the less severe forms that go into young adulthood, they're quite dysfunctional and impaired. And so we look at Pilzaeus-Merzbacher as an important target. There are a great number of the lysosomal storage diseases, things like Tay-Sachs disease and Krabbe's disease, Sandhoff's disease, a variety of related diseases that include Canavan's disease, Batten's disease, for example, that involve loss of myelin in the setting of, in the case of lysosomal storage diseases, storage abnormalities with the generation of toxic metabolites. In the case of Canavan's disease, of toxic agents, essentially, that kill oligodendrocytes. And these are disorders that are quite tragic in that the children will develop normally and then at a few years of age will begin to develop a failure in achieving developmental milestones and then lose myelin, demyelinate, and ultimately die. Some of the more profound disorders like the Batten's disease and related what are called neuronal ceroid lipofuscinoses involve demyelination, but those disorders involve more than just demyelination because neurons are involved as well. But in many of these conditions, the myelin is the primary target. And so we look at this strategy as potentially being useful in treating the lysosomal storage disorders as well. There's work by Evan Snyder's group and others over the past few years that have reported that the use of glial progenitor cells might be beneficial in the lysosomal storage disorders, not only from the standpoint of remyelination, as we're discussing here, but also by virtue of providing the deficient or missing enzyme back to the recipient tissue. And so in those cases, one would use a strategy like this not only to regenerate myelin, to replace myelin in the spinal cord from which it's been lost, but by the same token, one would be also replacing the enzyme that's missing in those host brains and presumably correcting the underlying defect that had led to the tissue loss in the first place. So that's effectively a dual-purpose function of the glial progenitor implants in those conditions. Now, all these early pediatric disorders of myelin essentially segue into a category of later-appearing leukodystrophies that are awfully, awfully severe themselves. They simply appear a little bit later in development. So the adrenal leukodystrophies, in fact, it's very timely, the Lorenzo Odoni, the child who was the subject of the movie Lorenzo's Oil some years back, had just passed away last week. And in any event, there was an adrenal leukodystrophy, which was very typical in its appearance in young childhood. Adrenal leukodystrophies, metachromatic leukodystrophies, these are additional genetic disorders of myelin that appear a little bit later in development and typically kill kids. And so, again, we're looking at this as a strategy that may be useful across that wide spectrum of disorders. Thankfully, none of these are common diseases, but as a group, they become common. And we're looking at them also from the standpoint of essentially using these as models and proofs of principle that will justify the extension of the strategy to much more common disorders of myelin. So cerebral palsy in children, many cases of cerebral palsy, a substantial fraction, if not an absolute majority, involve a primary loss of oligodendrocytes. So that when the germinal matrix of infants is lost in the setting of germinal matrix hemorrhage or postnatally in the setting of toxic or hypoxic insult, these kids lose the glial progenitor population itself, so their own glial progenitor cells are lost, and as a result, they don't generate new oligodendrocytes and don't generate myelin. And much of the pathology that we see neurologically in cerebral palsy cases is often due primarily to that lack of myelin, with the loss of neurons in those cases, in many cases, being secondary.
Now, I'm going to throw in a question here I didn't originally plan to ask you, but I'm sure other people are going to ask you this. So just based, Dr. Goldman, on what you just said and about looking for broader disorders, what about something like multiple sclerosis, which I guess that's some, from what I've read, it has some genetic component, environmental component, but it's certainly not as definitive as a genetic disorder as these diseases you just worked about. And I guess I'm asking you to speculate here. But again, from what you've seen with the mice, is there any indication that something like this has shed a light on one day using this to treat multiple sclerosis patients?
I can probably do more than speculate. It's something I've thought about quite a bit. So I'm not a pediatric neurologist. I'm an adult neurologist and treat MS patients and have throughout my career. And the fact of it is that MS was the target I had in mind when we started this work over a decade ago. The first models that we went into using these cells were adult models of acute demyelination, basically of multiple sclerosis. And the bottom line is, experimentally, is that the cells were competent to remyelinate adult axons and remain so. But the disease environment is a much trickier one than the congenital disorders of myelin. So in multiple sclerosis, first of all, you have an underlying immune process, an underlying autoimmune destruction of a person's own myelin. And that autoimmune process has to be controlled before one can think about putting cell grafts in. The worst thing would be to transplant cells into a patient with a stable demyelinating lesion and then simply have them develop yet another inflammatory attack that then would involve the implanted cells as well as the host zone. It's perfectly good reason to think that one might be adding fuel to the fire in that type of setting. So the underlying autoimmune disease of multiple sclerosis has to be very well controlled before one can even consider putting a cell graft in. And then the environment, the disease environment into which cells would be implanted is much more complex in multiple sclerosis than in the childhood disorders we've been discussing. In MS, the result of the chronic inflammatory attack is that there are regions of gliosis, meaning of glial scar formation within the brain, in regions that have already demyelinated. That's the word sclerosis in multiple sclerosis refers to that glial scar formation, and the fact that it's scattered throughout the brain makes it multiple sclerosis. So that's a significant problem in terms of being able to remyelinate axons that are still within those demyelinated regions. The nerve fibers themselves, the axons within an area that's been demyelinated, often are lost themselves. They either die by virtue of lack of support, or they are essentially the bystander victims of the immune attack and become transected, meaning physically cut in the setting of attack by immune cells. And of course, if those axons have been lost in any significant numbers, then there's not a whole lot of point to put cells such as ours that would be intended to remyelinate those axons if the axons themselves are lost. If the neurologic substrate isn't there, then there's not a whole lot that a remyelination strategy can accomplish. And so that argues for the absolute need to support the underlying neuronal structure, the axons, during MS episodes as a means of preserving the that neurologic substrate that can then be approached by virtue of a glial progenitor cell implant for purposes of remyelination. So MS, until these different issues are addressed in a satisfactory fashion, MS is not a target that is yet appropriate for this type of treatment.
Let's go back to your specific research technique. How do your studies differ from other research that focuses on remyelinating nerve cells? And in your response, can you talk about the technique you developed for the acquisition and purification of human fetal glial progenitor cells? And I also understand you developed a novel cell delivery strategy.
So we've been working on methods for both isolating and delivering these cells for some years. We're using glial progenitor cells derived from fetal brain tissue. We had started this work some years back using adult brain tissues and isolating glial progenitors from adult brain. We started this back in the late 90s at a time point where oligodendrocyte progenitors or glial progenitor cells actually had not yet been identified in a human brain, but we knew they were there on the basis of animal studies. And so we used a promoter-based strategy where we took green fluorescence protein, the genes encoding GFP, which of course is a jellyfish gene that glows green, and we placed this gene under the control of oligodendrocyte progenitor cell promoters, DNA regulatory regions that direct gene expression just to the oligodendrocyte progenitor. And we put those synthetic genes of the promoter-driving GFP into adult human white matter in the tissue culture dish, of course. And then the oligodendrocyte progenitor cells within that population then expressed the jellyfish fluorescent gene. And we were able to use fluorescence-activated cell sorting, a method for purifying fluorescent cells, to extract the glial progenitors from the larger population. Once we had those cells, we then identified different surface markers that they were expressing. And in the course of that work, identified a set of gangliosides expressed by these cells very specifically, for which we had antibodies, and were able to use those antibodies then to extract the cells from new tissues using a surface antibody-based strategy, also followed by fluorescence-activated cell sorting. So that was work that we did in the, maybe culminating 5 years ago, whereby we extracted and purified human oligodendrocyte progenitors from adult surgical resections and then transplanted the cells back into adult rats with demyelinating lesions, again, intended to mimic MS. And those lesions remyelinated very nicely. So it was a success from the standpoint of the cells, but we were skeptical because of the degree of axonal loss that we observed, that this would be a clinically useful strategy, at least until we had better models for multiple sclerosis and better control over actual MS patients. And that's when we made the shift to mouse models of congenital hypermyelination, because we actually thought that and now that we knew these cells would work, we became very optimistic that they might work in a very profound fashion. The extraction techniques we had developed were so high yield and so high efficiency that we realized that perhaps we could really extend the strategy, and besides just treating small demyelinating lesions intended to mimic MS, perhaps we could treat the entire nervous system. And so that's why we chose these genetic models in which myelin wasn't made at all, thinking that these would be just that much more extreme. If we could remyelinate the entire nervous system, then that would lay to rest any doubt that we could myelinate any portion of it. And so that's when we went to the shiver mouse, but by the same token, we realized that we would need cell sources that were potentially larger in terms of cell number. The adult human brain contains only a small percentage of these cells, of these glial progenitor cells. So we chose fetal tissues, and these were essentially autopsy tissues of vortices that were typically performed in the setting of premature rupture of the membranes or other conditions that culminated in abortion, and then we would have access to those tissues essentially on autopsy. And so these were pathology samples that we then used. We dissociated the tissues and then used the antibody-based extraction techniques that we developed for use in the adult brain, but we use them now in the fetal brain tissue. And since the fetal brain contains more of these cells than the adult, and the extraction techniques that we developed were of such high efficiency, we ended up with lots and lots of cells. And so suddenly went from the fractions of a million to a million that we might obtain from an adult surgical resection to hundreds of millions to, in some cases, billions. And that was, of course, more than enough to then set up a large series of studies in which we assess the capability of these cells to myelinate different congenital disease models in mice. So the protocol that we developed was one of taking fetal pathologic tissue, and by pathologic I simply mean autopsy. These are otherwise normal brain tissues. And we extract the oligodendrocyte progenitors using a dual two-color, if you will, FACS strategy. We can do it both ways, the alternative method being a magnetic sorting strategy. But in both cases, we're identifying two different markers on the cells. One is the set of gangliosides that I mentioned before. It's recognized by an antibody called A2B5, and that pulls out the glial progenitor cell, but it also pulls out some stage of neural progenitors that are already fated to give rise to neurons. And so then we use a second antibody against a neuronal surface protein called NCAM to extract out the neuronal progenitor cells from the larger glial progenitor population. And that gives us then the relatively pure population of glial progenitors that we then implant into the neonatal mice brain. The mouse brain at 1 day old is awfully small. And yet within that target region, we've identified five sites that we can inject into. And those five sites are sufficient if we achieve cell delivery to those five to achieve contiguous dispersal of the transplanted cells into the entire nervous system. And so that was a delivery strategy and a set of sites that that we, in this case, very specifically Martha Windrum, a faculty member in my group who's done most of this work. Martha identified these sites in the course of predicting essentially the migration patterns of these cells in the very early developing mouse brain. And upon delivering the cells to those sites, literally within 24 hours of birth, found that the cells, in fact, would migrate through the entire neuroaxis, meaning the entire brain and spinal cord, within the few weeks thereafter. And after that initial migration and dispersal of the cells, in fact, it takes many months for myelin to appear, and then many more months for myelin to really become so abundant as to effectively myelinate all of the resident axons. And so it's a very slow process. And again, as I mentioned before, the shiver mice normally dies at 20 to 21 weeks. And so the animals have 5 months, basically, to generate enough myelin to lessen their neurologic abnormalities, their neurologic disabilities, to attenuate those and improve the level of neurologic function to the point where they can at least survive that period. And those that that do so, that effectively take advantage of that five-month time window and myelinate sufficiently, then survive and go on to be rescued. And those that don't myelinate as efficiently as their counterparts, as their surviving counterparts, if they don't myelinate quickly enough, then by the time they start to really become quite impaired at 18, 20 weeks, then those animals don't survive past 21 weeks. And so it's very much a race against time after the cells are put in. So what we're trying to do now is to understand how to essentially modify the odds in ours and in the recipient mouse's favor to achieve higher proportions of rescue using the technique.
I'm John Sterling. Thanks for listening. If you would like to comment on this week's podcast, please go to our podcast section at www.genengnews.com and give us your thoughts. We'd really like to hear from you. Bye for now.
To learn more about topics discussed in this GenCast, or to listen to previous GenCasts, visit our website at www.genengnews.com. New GenCasts are posted every week, Thursday, 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. For the Gen Publishing editorial staff, I'm Jonathan Ellinghouse, saying thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in again next week to the GenCast Network.